This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So bold, rain is a gun. Fast to freedom,
stars tonight.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate Rewind and Rewatch, episode 28, covering Freedom Fight 2011 from B.B. King's Blues Bar and Grill from Manhattan, New York, from November 13th, 2011. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find our podcast on the Voices of Wrestling feed or on our own dedicated podcast feed on all podcast platforms and applications. You can follow us on Twitter at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, all donations would be certainly, we'd certainly appreciate it, but it's not at all required. Click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our red circle page. You click the red button, and you can do a single donation or a reoccurring one, and I'd like to take a moment to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of our hosts. It is your old pal, Iron Mike Spears, joined alongside, as always, Case Lowe. And Case, it's been a slog at some times. It's been very, very long. I feel like I could be absolutist about it. But we finally have watched and are prepared to review the final show of 2011 for Dragon Gate USA. It's all downhill from here in more ways than one. This was the busiest year in the promotion's history. It was the most confounding year in the promotion's history. But Case, we got through it together. We are through 2011. After this show, there will be only 22 episodes of reviews left. That means we'll end the show on a nice round episode 50.
Mike, I would hope that people donate to the show because we got to watch this main event, and that there needs to be some form of compensation there. I think because we had rumored doing an Evolve show at some point, but I think because we are going to end on 50 episodes, we'll just cover that Evolve show in depth, but that is not going to get its own episode. We're doing the 50 Dragon Gate USA shows and a wrap-up show, putting a bow on the entire thing. But I like it that we are moving towards a much different era in the promotion, as we have now, after the show, gotten through the busiest year, arguably the most newsworthy year in the promotion's history, and we are ending with one of the strangest shows in the company's history.
Yeah, just to get a sense of how insane of a year this was for Dragon Gate USA. We started the year with United New York City, and that was it. Their first ever show at BB King's. We were ending it here. People who are on that show who are no longer with us in the promotion: John Moxley, Jigsaw, Jimmy Jacobs, Austin Aries, and many more. So, Case, with how things have been in 2011 with Dragon Gate USA, I know we do not have many notes about Dragon USA proper going into their finale for 2011, but take me through the timeline for this show. I know that we have a lot of stuff. We have some Dragon Gate stuff. We have some other stuff around Japan. We have some stuff in the U.S. Indies to talk about.
Yeah, so as I've kind of talked about the past two episodes, the Dragon Gate USA newswire for these three shows, this triple shot to end the year, very sparse. Just not a ton going on there. I'm assuming Gabe was happy enough with the early run on attendance that he didn't feel the need to push the show as Gabe typically would. So there's nothing from the newswire today. I know 2 weeks ago we talked about what was going on in Japan, the Akira Tozawa versus Masaki Mochizuki Dreamgate match, and everything leading up to this second week of November Dragon Gate USA triple shot. Last week was some US indie stuff. We talked about CZW, AIW, a Chikara show. We're gonna bounce around the globe here. We've got some Japan notes, we've got some US indie notes before the show. And then after we talk about Freedom Fight, we will close out the year in Dragon Gate proper in Japan, 2011. So some stuff before the show, some stuff after the show, and we start with the October 7th Mil Máscaras 40th anniversary of Coming to Japan, anniversary show that happened in Corken Hall. What is notable here, yes, it is a show that featured the likes of Yoshiaki Fujiwara wrestling Kikutaru, Jinichiro Tenryu, Jinsei Shinzaki, and Great Sasuke teamed against El Samurai, Kensuke Sasaki, and Prince Devitt. But the meat of this show, the main event, Dos Caras, First Tiger Mask, and Mil Máscaras defeated the team of Tiger Mask 4, Ultimo Guerrero, and Shima. And in the October 17th, 2011 Wrestling Observer newsletter, Dave says, a celebration of the 40th anniversary of Mil Máscaras' first tour of Japan show took place in Corken Hall before 1,250 fans. In a double main event, Máscaras and Dos Caras, an original Tiger Mask, beat Ultimo Guerrero, Shima, and Tiger Mask, would Máscaras pin Guerrero in 17-13 with a flying body press. This would be the equivalent of, very literally, Bruno Sammartino being brought back to the WWF this week in a trios match and pinning Randy Orton clean. Mike, have you seen this show before? I do not have any recollection of this.
No, I have not seen this show. I'm looking at the card right now. This is a wild-ass card. I'm willing to guess that this was a show that was helped produced by Nasao Rongai. He loves having old luchadors over on his shows and having young up-and-comers job to it. It has a single rating on Cage Match of a 4. Other people on this show, we have Black Tiger, Sasuke the Great, and Yu Yamagata defeating Gran Hamada, Nasao Rongai, and Takumi Chinoku. This is here's a pretty wild tag match. Senshiro Takagi and Yuzuki Aikawa defeating Mayu Iwatani and Passion Naki. You probably don't know of Yuzuki Aikawa, but she is the first ever like ace of Stardom. So defeating Mayu Iwatani, who now is kind of the eternal ace of Stardom. And yeah, like Ultimo Guerrero in 2011, like having that fall, that's insane, because Ultimo Guerrero is arguably at like his working peak. Then this was like during the, I believe this was during the big tag team he had with Rey Bucanero. So that is a wild thing, and I don't think Dave is off the point there with what he said about that match.
There's truly nothing Nozawa loves more than being dommed by old luchadors. It is his favorite thing, and I do respect him for that. But when it comes to weird tag team matches, Mike, we have to look at New Japan. At the end of 2011, October 22nd through November 6th, the G1 Tag League 2011. And Mike, why do we mention this?
Well, we mention this because we have a team from War teaming up, as it is, of course, Tomohiro Ishii teaming up with someone who I think maybe had like a little bit of training in War, but he got the majority of it. He did work for War, and Don Fuji. It was the Tenryu produced show, a tag team in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so Fuji and Ishii teamed together in the 2011 G1 Tag League. It is a real shame they are not running this back in 2020, or at least we don't know if they are, but I'm going to guess they're not.
Oh, be still my heart if that was the case.
Oh, my God, could you imagine? Because, look, 2011 New Japan is just not the same. Their B-block matches, they wrestle Hideo Saito, who was Bone Soldier. They wrestle Bone Soldier and Takashi Iizuka in Corken Hall in their opening match that ended in a DQ, by the way, after 10 minutes. They also wrestled Shinsuke Nakamura and Toru Yano, Hiroshi Tenzan and Wataru Inoue, Hiroki Goto and Hiroshi Tanahashi. Now that match I would like to see. Goto and Tanahashi versus 2020 Fuji and Ishii, signed me up. And Satoshi Kojima and Togi Makabe defeating Fuji and Ishii in the final match of block play. They ended the tournament. Corken Hall, November 6, 2011. They wrestled in the opener. It was Hideo Sato, Takashi Iizuka, and Tomohiro Ishii teaming with Don Fuji to defeat Hiromu Takahashi, King Fale, Kyosuke Mikami, and Takaaki Watanabe. What an opener. And just for historical purposes, the finals of the G1 Tag League that year, Lance Archer and Minoru Suzuki defeating Bad Intentions of Giant Bernard and Carl Anderson. But Mike, what about that Corken Hall opener? That sounds better than any of their block matches.
I mean, I kind of want to see them against Kojima and Makabe. That would be interesting, especially 2011 Makabe, you know? Let's put it in context there. Like, this isn't only going to do three bumps and is more interested in talking about sweeps on Japanese variety television, Togi Makabe. But yeah, no, that opening match, it's wild considering who that all is as young lines there. You have like the future. It's just insane. Like the people that are there. And it also makes you think about how long it takes for New Japan to get people going, considering who was on that undercard in 2011.
Yeah, it's Hiromu, Fale, El Desperado, and Evil. So, you know, three of those wrestlers have really improved since then, and then there's Evil. So we've got that to deal with on the New Japan side of things.
The only time that Fale has been compared positively to someone in 2020.
The only time it will happen. And as we go forward within the 2012 and 2013 shows, there'll be a little bit more New Japan coverage because they tend to matter in the wrestling landscape a little bit more. But we are going to go to a show that took place a little bit after Freedom Fight 2011, actually a full month after, December 23rd, 2011, from the Hammerstein Ballroom. It is Ring of Honor Final Battle 2011 on a show. Mike, what do you remember about this show? Does anything jump to your mind when it comes to, you know, all the final battles, all the great matches? What about Final Battle 2011?
Well, Dan Severn's there. I mean,
and that makes it worth buying a ticket, my friend.
I mean, guy who just comes out there. I mean, and former NWA World's Heavyweight Champion Dan Severn, just absolute unit. Wrestles in a crew neck sweatshirt with no sleeves. Like, I'm thinking about the Lions Den. I'm thinking about the basement match. Like, it's like such a wild thing. It's an interesting show. And of course, most importantly, the main event, we have our good friend, close friend of the show, cutting a promo on his ex-wife.
Before we get to Davey owning his ex-wife, verbally, of course, the full card. Michael Elgin defeated TJ Perkins. What a funny match 9 years later. Just pure joy with Elgin and TJP in the same ring. Tommaso Ciampa of the Embassy defeated Jimmy Rave, formerly of the Embassy. There's a three-way title match for the ROH TV title with Jay Lethal retaining over Mike Bennett and El Generico, someone who we will start hearing a lot more about at future shows. No DQ match with Jimmy Jacobs as the special guest referee. Kevin Steen defeated Steve Corino and worked his way back into Ring of Honor through that match. There is an ROH World Tag Team Title Number 1 Contendership Tag Team Gauntlet with the Young Bucks, fresh off of their TNA run, defeating the CNC Wrestle Factory, Future Shock, the All Night Express, and the Bravado Brothers. Mike, is there a more 2011 sounding match than that?
I mean, that is really the state of the ROH tag team division right there. like let's call a spade. The ROH tag team division has been dirt a lot throughout its existence, and yeah, because those are your new number one contenders, and then 1 through 5, and then you have a match later on that. Wow, yeah. I'm not going to say that. I was going to say, was the Ring of Honor Tag Team Division ever really good? But yes, it was.
Yeah,
but
no, there was a short time there.
Yeah. But this is real statement of the division right there. Looking at those teams, I mean, I'm certain that there is a universe that the CNC Wrestle Factory still exists.
Oh, God, yeah. No, if you that's like, Cedric could be released tomorrow and realistically should go on to do great things in AEW. He could tour New Japan. It would be this incredible force. Really, he's just gonna team with Caprice again. Like, the CNC Wrestle Factory will never die. One of the best tag team names of all time.
I mean, yeah. Caprice Coleman, what a guy.
I really respect him. Really has churned out quite the career. More power to him. Also on the show, the final three matches, Roderick Strong defeated Chris Hero. I believe this was an open challenge match. People thought Hero would have been reporting to FCW at the time. Instead, Hero worked this show. And then Hero also worked a show at the beginning of 2011 for Ring of Honor, the Homecoming 2012 show, in which he wrestled and lost to Michael Elgin on a show that I'm looking at the card now. Hollow Wicked and Jigsaw defeat the Briscoe Brothers. How about that? Which brings us to the World Tag Team title match, where the Briscoe Brothers defeated the world's greatest tag team for the ROH tag belts, and then your main event, 41 minutes and a superplex gif later, Davey Richards defeats Eddie Edwards with Dan Severn by his side.
I mean, I did it. I did it all. We've been through a lot together. Fucking Jen. We've done it. Like, a lot of people remember that suplex. I remember that promo.
Dude, Davey's so awesome. God, I wish he was still in Dragon Gate USA. That is really an alternate timeline that I would like to explore, because realistically, we're probably looking at Davey Richards versus Johnny Gargano as the main event of this show. And, well, I guess it's the semi-main event of this show. And it would have been incredible to see. That is the state of Ring of Honor as we head into 2012. There is one more promotion we need to talk about before Freedom Fight 2011. And, Mike, it is the promotion that is running this same night on Go Fight Live iPay-Per-View from the Asylum Arena in Philadelphia. It is Chikara High Noon, one of the most infamous shows in the promotion's history, with The Colony opening up the show, defeating the Young Bucks, Sarah Del Rey defeating Jacob Hammermeyer, Green Ant defeating Tursas, Colt Cabana defeating Archibald Peck in what I'm sure was just a delightful match, Icarus defeats Gregory Iron, Hollow Wicked and Ultra Mantis Black, they defeat Eris and Tim Donst. In your main event, 12 large summit final match, Eddie Kingston with Tommy Dreamer defeats Mike Quackenbush.
Yeah, and like the big note here is like this was their first ever iPay-Per-View. It was not only a success on iPay-Per-View, beating the not Final Battle but the ROH iPay-Per-View before that, and then just like shattering what I assume was DGUSA numbers, but also getting 864 people in the arena. So this was like the real banner moment in Chikara's history. And it's one of those things that it is something that still kind of is remarkable in a way that now we're starting to see other promotions go to iPay-Per-View other than DGUSA and Ring of Honor and knocking it out of the park for the first show. Like, I remember this show pretty well. And then, of course, like, the big thing about the main event and had, like, one of those tremendous Eddie Kingston promos beforehand talking about he's winning this title, which was all based around Larry Sweeney's passing. We've talked about that a couple months ago on the show. And the fact that he was awarded the title by Larry Sweeney's brother and girlfriend, or like on again, off again girlfriend, and like how emotional of a moment that was. And, you know, I mean, for like the time period, this was like such a big show. And it's in a lot of ways kind of was the peak of Chikara's relevance in my mind.
Oh, this is as big as it got for Chikara. You could make the rational argument if pro wrestling was logical that Eddie Kingston would have been thrown a contract for an unlimited amount of money after the promo that he cut to build to this match. And look, Eddie Kingston's doing all right now, and I'm someone that has often faded Eddie Kingston throughout his career, but the 12 large hype promo, one of the greatest promos I've ever seen. I mean, it is really just a special match and a special show, and it is peak Chikara. And as we get into 2012, and especially 2013, and then towards the dying days in 2014, we will keep track of just the amount of promotions running internet pay-per-views, the change in the iPay-Per-View model, and of course, the frustrations with the iPay-Per-View. But for now, Mike, I am ready to go to Freedom Fight 2011.
I am as well. This was, of course, on November 13th from B.B. King's Blues Bar and Grill. The only other thing that like really happened was Chuck Taylor took the Dragon Gate USA title to Easton, Pennsylvania for the show for Chikara the night before. He was not on that one, but that became a major storyline throughout the show here as we open up with Blood Warriors backstage. They are cackling, trashing all their opponents. They're specifically having Ricochet trash talk Pack. And it was just like a big thing of like all of them just getting together, just cackling heelishly going, "Oh yeah, Blood Warriors is dominated this weekend. They've actually had a really bad weekend. Each one with wins and losses. But it doesn't matter because Ricochet is going to beat Pac, and Akira Tozawa and BB Hulk are going to beat Ronin. Ronin are scourged. They're not going to worry about it. And then next year, they're going to go back. They already are the Open the United Gate champions, but then they will have the Open the Freedom Gate title coming out of this. Just kind of like a charming thing. I mean, having Brody Lee here kind of as like someone who was like cackling on the sidelines and not leading this promo is going to infinitely frustrate me, but I thought that this was a pretty kind of funny and lighthearted way to start the show with like your sniveling heels.
We got Shima to talk and we got Brody Lee to talk, and that is a winning combination for any promo.
Yeah. And then we had Johnny Gargano talking about the last night. He says it's 3 years of building to this, and he says he's not the bonus match boy he was before, but he's going to be the Freedom Gate man. And, you know, Johnny Gargano's promos, and I'll get into this a little bit later, I mean, it's effective. He's an effective promo, like getting the points across here, but I don't think he's a great promo guy. So, or at least face promo guy. And this, I feel like, was like the first of like, oh yeah, we're entering this era of Johnny Gargano. This is going to be something for me to stomach.
It's a good promo. This is a good promo. My issue with this, and I guess we can talk about this now and then focus on the match when we get into it. This moment does not feel big enough because Gargano, like we've said all of 2011 as we've gone through these shows, he lost the United Gate title tournament. He lost to Shima in a singles match. He lost their Mercury Rising six man. Even though he pinned, or I guess submitted, Shima and Austin Aries in this building, he still lost to Austin Aries in a singles match. He lost to Akira Tozawa in a singles match. And just two shows ago, he lost to Brody Lee and Shima in a tag team match. I have real mixed emotions on the build of this match because I think in a bubble, they've done a really great job of elevating Gargano. But in the grand scheme of things, this match did not feel as big as it should have.
Yeah. And I guess we could compare and contrast here. I feel like Chuck Taylor's video the night before was more effective building up someone to a title than the overly long and narrated videos by Johnny Gargano. Like,
the Occupy Philly stuff was great. A week after that, now that it's really sat with me for a while, I really liked that promo.
Yeah. And whereas, like, you could tell, like, that was, like, the thing is, like, I guess we had to do something to build up Chuck Taylor for this match that he wasn't going to win. But, like, building, like, and crowning the champion that will be the champion pretty much the remainder of this promotion, like, it did feel kind of like, oh, okay. Like, I knew this was going to happen. I've watched this match many times, but, like, watching these videos for the first time in years, I was like, oh, okay. Like, it completion grade promo doing this gets, like, the full completion grade is just, you know, as you said, the booking and then my personal belief that Johnny Gargano is not a great face promo just detracts a little bit, in my opinion.
What about this BJ Whitmer promo that followed?
Well, my notes were Lenny is introducing the show and we get BJ on immediately and he wants Brody Lee now. I mean, BJ, promo guy, should not even hit the microphone. He should have just stormed the ring and say, give me Brody Lee, and that would have been more effective.
Yeah. As for the match, we open up the show. Of course, it's arguably the biggest Dragon Gate USA show of all time. And what do we open up with? Well, it's BJ Whitmer versus Brody Lee. That is the reality we're living in. It's not exactly BB Hulk versus Yamato. It's instead BJ Whitmer versus Brody Lee. And look, I thought this match was pretty good, all things considered. BJ Whitmer, with the right opponent, it was not a bad wrestler. I mean, at times was a very good wrestler. I will say, I hate the Peruvian necktie. I'm glad that
garbage
move did not
finish.
Catch on. What an awful looking move. But before I get into the bigger point about Brody Lee, Mike, what do you think about this match?
I mean, I thought it was decent. 2.5 stars. Brody got the win with a second Liger Bomb in about 7 minutes. The exact time was 7:37. A lot of dark brawling. A lot of brawling in the dark where they did not have lights. And that's a problem throughout the show.
Indeed it is. But Mike, I've said for the past two shows, I am reserving my thoughts on BJ Whitmer for this show. And look,
Unload King. It's your time.
Because what I'm about to say is not an indictment of BJ Whitmer. I don't even really, I mean, look, when I have booked him, no, of course not. Strang at USA. BJ Whitmer does not need to be on the shows. My issue is not BJ Whitmer himself. My issue is that this is the final show that Brody Lee worked for the promotion. He doesn't fly out to Los Angeles, and he signed before WrestleMania weekend 2012. And you don't book Brody versus Uha? What are you doing? Because the rash argument, and Mikey, this might be what you're saying, is, hey, Uha Nation, he's coming in, he's going to be in Blood Warriors real soon, but he replaces Brody Lee in Blood Warriors.
Right.
At this point, he's unaffiliated. He has no ties to any unit in Japan. For them to not book Brody Lee versus Uha Nation on this show with Uha going over is so grossly irresponsible. And I waited in my notes. I waited for the next match that Uha is in. I said, well, maybe they do an angle where Brody Lee and Uha stare face to face and they build to a match that just doesn't happen because Brody is not signed by the next show, the Golden Gate show in LA at the start of 2012. According to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, Brody reports to FCW in early March. So again, before WrestleMania weekend, but after the Golden Gate show. So maybe they were building up to something there, but no, they weren't. Gabe spent Brody Lee's last weekend in the promotion booking him against BJ Whitmer, and that did nothing for anybody. They never paid off the angle in Chicago where Uha got the best of Brody Lee, and it's so frustrating because so much of Brody Lee's run in Dragon USA was just doing meaningless matches. Mike, he worked three different six-way frays. He worked an open invitational elimination match in Indianapolis in the Midwest. You could make an argument that with the exception of the Blood Warriors versus Ronan and Yoshino match in this building at the second anniversary show where Brody Lee injured himself, he was never in a match of consequence. He was teaming with Aki Bono. He was squashing Rich Swann and Stalker Ichikawa and Chuck Taylor and Tony Nese. But those squash matches never went anywhere. And they finally had a chance to make it all pay off, to have a new monster come in, to get 2012 started with a new man to fear in the promotion. And they booked Brody Lee versus BJ Whitmer, who never shows up again.
And Case, I'm glad you did this because I had written on my whiteboard since I brought up initially, Cardinal Sin, yes?
What specifically? I mean, you could make the argument Brody Lee and the way they handled him as a Cardinal Sin, but not booking him versus Uha on the final weekend is inexcusable. It's horrible.
So two Cardinal Sins. Okay. I like counting sins. I'm a big fan of this. So I'm writing down my notes. Brody Lee in general, Cardinal Sin.
Brody
and no Uha.
I think it's obviously easy to say with 9 years of hindsight and looking at what Brody Lee is currently doing at AEW, it's easy to say, oh, well, they should have pushed him. But when you watch these shows,
he was displaying it there.
Week after week. I mean, the fact that it took him until 2012 to be signed to FCW is absurd. Because he can talk, he can move, and he's big.
Yeah.
And it really seemed like the Dragon Gate guys liked working with him. He fit into Blood Warriors. Why he didn't challenge Yamato for the Freedom Gate belt ever blows me away. On top of the fact that, like I ranted about during the Atlanta shows WrestleMania weekend, how did they not give Mox his farewell against Brody Lee? Mike, could you imagine how effective that would have been if Moxley and Kamikaze were destroyed by Blood Warriors and Brody Lee in Atlanta, and then at the end of the year, Uha Nation, who was still a blue-chip prospect, I mean, relatively unknown. It's like a quarterback going to high school in North Dakota. Nobody knows about this guy until he shows up and starts destroying everybody, and they don't even give him the Brody Lee send-off. It's unbelievable.
And on top of all of this, Kamikaze USA would be dead by the time they had their next triple shot.
They completely had the out. It's
yeah.
Because they tried to do like a double turn with Yamato and Tozawa turning against Mox, and it just did not work. The plan, again, it should have been Shima Doi and Brody or Shima Ricochet Brody against Tozawa, Yamato, Mox, and then do Blood Warriors versus Ronin on the next night. And with, you know, Shima Doi Ricochet, and do Brody versus Mox on the final show that Mox was on. It was, I hated Mox's farewell. It neglected so much of what he did right his entire time in the promotion. Brody Lee, on the other hand, was just wasted his entire time. And this is the end of Brody Lee and Mike. As we go along Golden Gate, and then especially after Mania Weekend, we are saying goodbye to a lot of people that never come back. And we never get the proper send-off. They're not replacing this talent with new guys that can get over. It's Moxley disappearing, and now Brody Lee is suddenly the guy. And then Uha Nation shows up, but then Brody Lee disappears, and Uha Nation doesn't really get, you know, crowned as the guy. And we start seeing these problems that are going to unravel and become out of control in 2012 and 2013. It's just like the US indie scene now. So many guys left so quickly that the pond became empty. All of a sudden, there were small fish in a small pond. Nobody was over. Nobody was dominant. But it's inexcusable to not push Uha Nation over Brody Lee. It was inexcusable to not push Brody Lee over Jon Moxley. It was an entire year of missteps and errors of execution with Brody Lee. And this match, again, it's nothing against BJ Whitmer, but why was he in this match? Because this was a fine match, but it wasn't Brody versus Uha.
And you could argue that this became a time where Gabe lost his fastball. Because right after 2009, You had Davey Richards as a star. You had Jon Moxley, who was going to be coming in as a star. You had the Young Bucks. All of them are gone before the end of WrestleMania, or three of those people will be gone by the end of WrestleMania week in 2010. The other one's gone by the end of WrestleMania week in 2011. He had the
I think you have to include TJP in that list as well. TJP, whether you like him or not, TJP was going to be a star in this promotion, or at least pushed as such, and Gabe ran him out of the promotion. Now, look, TJP, I wouldn't want to deal with him either, but all things considered, the 2010 indie wrestling landscape, TJP is headlining this promotion.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think you're wrong on this. And then also you had someone like Brian Kendrick. Like, you had people that they were clearly had hopes on that were out pretty quickly, but he already had next ups. He was able to get Chikara Sekigun around for a while, and then he was able to segue that into Ronin as like your major American force. There's not going to be that. I mean, you talked about the Bravado Brothers. The Bravado Brothers will be out of Ring of Honor real soon, and they will be big fixtures around here. And you look at this, and you're just like, oh, this is how you probably mismanage the most talented big man of this era. And you're just like, look at this. And yes, hindsight, now we're looking at a show that's almost 9 years old. But you could look back at like the whole arc of Brody Lee. And I mean, from a guy who's just coming in there and just beating up people for no good reason, and wanting to fight someone from Japan, to like being the best microphone, the best native microphone worker in Blood Warriors, to this, it's just completely deflating and an incredibly huge mismanagement, I would say.
It sucks. I don't like it. After the match, Lenny Leonard said BJ Whitmer won, which is the only time I've ever heard Lenny make a mistake like that. And so it was just, ugh, it was too much at once. I was so bummed coming out of this opener.
Yeah. So that happened. Then we went backstage with Yamato, where Yamato's mad because Chuck Taylor stole his belt, and he wants to take the belt back to Japan because he is the Open the Freedom Gate champion, and he thinks Chuck Taylor is a piece of trash. And they had it with translation, and it was, Yamato was like cutting half promo in English, half promo in Japanese. They should have done this all throughout the promotion.
Absolutely. Good little promo here. I liked it.
Yep. And then we had a next match where Brody went on to commentary yet again, most talented tall man in recent wrestling history, where he was there to commentate a match that's real, real full circle as the match would be UHA Nation and now Dark Order member John Silver versus The Scene. The Scene would get the pin on John Silver with the obscene in 10 minutes and 44 seconds in a really, really fun tag match. Like, this is like where they're using UHA here after we saw him get kind of exposed. This was a perfect use of it, and John Silver stepped up, and John Silver was a perfectly competent member here that I hope sticks around a little bit.
Yeah, Silver worked Evolve 9 against Tony Nese in this building, and I don't remember that match specifically. I know we talked about it a few episodes ago, but I'm assuming he made a good enough impression on Gabe here to book him over Tony Nese, there was an NWYC pre-show card before this that Mike, I looked at the card, and oh my God, the names on that show, the only one I knew was Tony Nese. I didn't even bother putting it in the notes because it looked like such a disaster. But John Silver gets the opportunity here. He and UHA were a nice little hodgepodge team. UHA looked great. UHA looked, there's a spot where The Scene tries to whip him into the barricade, like both of them Irish whipping him at the same time. And UHA just counters and clotheslines them both. And it's like, oh my God, like this guy is such a monster. And is clearly starting to put it together. And as we'd see at the start of 2012, he would really have the foundation, and then it was yanked away from him just all too soon. Such a bummer. But yeah, it's a nice little match, and Brody Lee on commentary, I was waiting for him to start some sort of angle with UHA, and it never happened. And that's where I lost my mind in my notes.
Yep. But Brody, good on color. Other people on the show who are on color that actively detracted from a match, but we'll get into that when we get into that. Yeah, no, I thought this was pretty solid, and I feel like this was a big step forward for UHA, especially after how he was kind of left exposed in the fray. We had a promo for the second anniversary DVD. Would you believe that the second anniversary show, which feels like months ago for us, was only 5 months before this? So Gabe's doing okay, I guess, on DVD sales. And then we had a backstage with Ronin. Johnny was apologizing, saying like he had to do it, but he tells Chuck, you have to return the belt, you can't do that. Chuck says, yeah, I'll eventually return the belt. And then Rich Swann tries to play peacemaker,
and that leads into what I thought was an excellent tag match between Ronin of Chuck Taylor and Rich Swann versus Blood Warriors of Mike, your team, BB Hulk and Akira Tozawa.
All right. I can already tell by your voice that I'm higher than you on this match.
No. Go ahead. I'll let you take this one.
This is a match that is insane. It's 15 minutes, 21 seconds. Swan got the pin on Akira Tozawa with a standing 450 splash. Darkside Hulk and Chuck Taylor have great chemistry. Like, insanely, like, going like, okay, no, these two guys actually rock together. And, of course, you already had Tozawa and Swan playing off, like, the last few weeks. And then I'm happy that I forgot that there was a Chuck and Swan, like, little mini tag team run, because I'm really stoked for them, because these two have great chemistry here. This match ruled. I absolutely loved it, and I know that this is full Tozawa bias going on right here. But after, like, with how wrestling was in 2011, I want to pose this question to you, Kez.
Okay.
With how wrestling was in 2011, I think the blowaway best tag team was the Spike Mohicans. I think that's fair to say. At least,
yes,
between the two of them. Hulk and Akira has to be number two.
Yeah, because there's no Junction 3 team that teams consistently enough and long enough, because Pac and Dragon Kid have their big match, but then it goes to Dragon Kid and Yoshino, and there's just not... There's no consistency on the Junction 3 side, and then if you look just around the wrestling world that year, as I quickly scramble for Tag Team of the Year and the Observer Awards, because, I mean, you gotta remember, 2011 tag teams, it's a really young Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly, it's the Briscoe brothers being excellent, but the Young Bucks are coming off of their TNA run. Now, the issue with the Observer voting is, look, Tag Team of the Year was Giant Bernard and Carl Anderson. I never got into their matches, but more power to them. Second place, I get it. Yeah,
That makes sense for them.
Yeah, I get it, but I don't like it. The Briscoe brothers are number two. Daisuke Sakamoto and Yuji Okabayashi are number three. 87 first place votes. Good for them. I love that tag team. I don't remember 2011 specifically being like a dynamite year for them. But more power to them. And then from there, you go into World's Greatest Tag Team, Young Bucks, Apollo 55, and then Shima and Ricochet. Rounding out the top 10, it's Bobby Roode and James Storm, Kofi Kingston and Evan Bourne, and Manabu Soya and Seiya Sanada.
So this is a personal assault against me, is what you're saying. That's fine.
Look, Mike, I'm not voting Beer Money ahead of Hulk and Tozawa, and I like Beer Money, but I'm not the one saying that. So you can't shoot the messenger. You just kind of have to deal with it, Mike.
Oh no, you are not the person who's wronging me here. But just in general, y'all failed because this match owned so much. I went 4.5 stars.
Oh my god!
like I was like watching this match because I watched this show split. I watched everything up until the Freedom Gate match last night, and then I watched the rest of this over my lunch break. This match, oh god, it scratches at my particular itch, and I know I'm entirely high on this match, and I know that it's something that you're probably like, this is a good solid match, 3.75 stars. No, this is 4.5 stars for Mike Spears. This is my thing. This ruled. There was an open the back rake gate joke by Lenny and Brody. This is one of those matches that, if you were a tag team wrestler and you were to watch the show, check out this match because it was really awesomely worked. I absolutely loved it.
I'm looking at Feud of the Year here, and it says that the 8th best feud of 2011 was Sanada and Soya versus Sakamoto and Okabayashi. I'm sure I've seen those matches, but I don't remember them being that great. So I know Alan Forrell is probably listening to the show in February 2022. So, Alan, I apologize for not remembering that era of Strong BJ. Mike, 3.75... you nailed
it. How good am I?
But look, I loved this match. It's funny that you gravitated towards Hulk and Chuck Taylor, because I was once again, specifically the individual of Rich Swann, but Swann and Tozawa, back-to-back nights, just killed it. And this is a 15-minute match, and once it got going, it went. I mean, when they turned it up, this became... It's just a phenomenal, phenomenal undercard tag match. And I am, you know, for as frustrated as I am with the booking of Brody Lee, I thought a lot of Jon Moxley's run was mismanaged. Just the lack of respect given to Rich Swann really fascinates me, because he's a guy that, you know, was buried on some of these shows, was jobbed out. And you look at his talent, especially after June when he became a full-time Dragon Gate roster member, I mean, he's unbelievable in this match. And it's, you know, we never really get the Chuck Taylor, Rich Swann tag run that we really needed to get. I don't think they team again in this promotion, which is a travesty. I mean, how you're not going into WrestleMania weekend with the idea of Swann and Taylor gunning for these belts, I do not know, but they teamed here. They teamed against the Scene in Milwaukee, and I like that match quite a bit. They will team on Evolve 10, a tribute to the arena. And then from there, we get into another era of booking when it comes to Chuck Taylor. So this is the end of the run. And obviously, WrestleMania weekend 2012 is plagued by injuries, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. But I don't believe the original plan was Taylor and Swann headlining for a United Gate title match. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And just to give a sense of like how big of an upset this is in overall Dragon Gate booking, we talked about, I think it was before the shows in September, about how Summer Venture Tag League 2011 was the Hulk and Akira show, where they just stormed through the competition. First off, defeating one of the old school tag teams in Araiwa, then defeating Kagetora and Shisa, defeating Kid and Yoshino, and then defeating Masaki Mochizuki and Yamato. This tag team, even though they were not the people in their unit with the tag team belts, that will come soon. This tag team was like utterly dominant in a way that was remarkable. So huge upset. And, you know, and right afterwards, Blood Warriors being mad, they attacked post-match. Gargano and Yoshino make the save. And that leads us right into the next match, Shima versus Masato Yoshino. Masato Yoshino would win this match in 20 minutes and 9 seconds with the very rare Soul Naciente Kai.
I should note, during that Blood Warrior attack, Brody Lee left the commentary table to run in, and I was like, oh my god, great, UHA Nation will make the save. And Mike, that did not happen.
I mean, yet again.
So
yet again.
They had so many opportunities on this show alone to do it, and they didn't do it. But, Mike, this Shima versus Yoshino match, oh my god, I love this. We're just off the bat, star rating, where are you at for this?
4 stars flat.
As am I.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I will say this. Look, this is at a point in time where Masato Yoshino clearly does not want to be working these shows, but he is. He's worked every Dragon Gate USA show up to this point besides Open the Southern Gate, and Shima has been on all the shows, obviously. This is such a unique match where they put forth max effort without doing a main event style match. And I think just the way Dragon Gate Japan is booked, this is a style of match that you really don't see. Like, just the booking and the lack of singles matches do not permit matches like this to take place. But this is like a prime zone match on steroids, because it's grappling based, and Shima and Yoshino just get to do a lot of things that, you know, although the match went 20 minutes, if they're in a singles match in Japan, it's probably going 30 minutes. So they had a chance to experiment with one another. And it was just so interesting. There was no match that we've seen so far during this project that really feels like this, because it felt like two guys working smarter, not harder. And I'm a huge fan, 4 flat.
Yeah, and it's not, and there is...
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, but with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club slab pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's going to be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably going to get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, ah, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing, you know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You get a display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading, so you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, sending these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally, and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They are on standby for you 24/7, so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy Video Lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived, and really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys, reach in my pocket, or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy Video Lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition, 1 second. Door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
It's a time in this match where they kick it up a notch.
Like, oh, this absolutely.
This isn't like a 20-minute mat work special, but this is something where, like, I think they realized the kind of match that happened. So they started off pretty slow, and a lot of really brutal arm work that Yoshino did. And this actually might be one of Shima's best, like, technical displays, because, like, selling the arm. And then I do have this written in my notes. I could totally get why Yoshino was done with going to America with this match, getting kicked really hard in the stomach. Like there's a moment where, like, Shima doesn't pull a kick and boots him right in the stomach. So I think Shima's a little pissed about the arm work a little bit. And then It had like such a great sprint finish with like one of the grossest looking lightning spirals that got a two count. And this is another thing. Brody Lee was like openly like going for his guy, like, Shima, no. And then as soon as like he locked in, he hooked the leg for the Kai, the Soul Nascente Kai, you felt like this deflation of him. He's like, why isn't anyone out here? I can't leave this stage. And it's just like very awesome heel commentator awareness of, you were just out there. You could come out there and do this if you really want to, but you're not going to, but you're going to blame it on everyone else. And I thought that this was truly exceptional match. And I thought that this was something that, you know, it started off very slow, and it's something that, I mean, it really played into it. It's a match that cannot ever happen now, but be very interested to see if this match would happen in a context of like a WrestleMania weekend match. I feel like on a Bloodsport show. Like, so I feel like that'd be very interesting.
That's what it's closer to. I mean, it's not quite the same base as T2P, but it feels like an evolution of a T2P match. And it's, you know, it's got Yoshino in it, so it makes sense. It's just a really different kind of match that I wish we had a whole portfolio of Shima working the style, because I think he excels at it. And it's just a real bummer that we never get to see it all that often, with the exception of the super gimmicky Super Shisa matches, which were great, but those were like 7-minute matches. This was 20 minutes and felt like a big time match. It was just worked in a different style than what we normally see.
Yeah, exactly. And then after that, we have another big singles match, as it is Ricochet versus Pac. Ricochet defeating Pac with a spinning head kick after 22 minutes and 42 seconds. And okay, so you've been the person that's kind of been following this feud throughout the store, throughout Dragon Gate USA, so I want you to take point on this. What were your thoughts about this?
You know what's crazy? Look, I've talked at length. I think all of Ricochet's success can be credited towards Pac in 2011. I think this feud, I mean, you look at Ricochet at Final Gate 2010, when he wins his first Triangle Gate match in Japan, to Final Gate 2011, which we'll talk about after we're done breaking down Freedom Fight 2011, and his feud with Pac, which lasted, you know, 5 singles matches in 2011, 3 in Japan, 2 in Dragon Gate USA. This is, by 2 seconds, the longest match that they had together. They went 22-42 here. They went 22-40 in Osaka on a show that we'll talk about in just a minute. I think this is the weakest of their 5 matches.
Really? I actually was really high on this one.
Look, part of it was, it's weird to think that Pac and Ricochet did crowd brawling, but they did crowd brawling, yeah. And at one point, it looks like Ricochet kind of catwalks on a railing into a Hurricane Rana, but the venue was so dark that I can't see it, so I can't judge it. And it was, I'm glad this match happened, because I think they worked out all of the kinks so that 6 days later in Osaka, they went on to have arguably the best match of either man's career. That Pac Ricochet match in Osaka number 2 is almost perfection, 4 3/4. This is like a trial run for that match, and maybe it's because I knew what was coming literally 6 days from this show that had me down on this. But, you know, the first match in March in Corken Hall, it's 15 minutes of spots. I mean, it's just a wild match, and I don't even think we have the full version of it. I think we have a clipped-down version.
No, we don't.
That is, it's even more spots. It's unbelievable. They have a match in June that I think is super underrated because it's just violent. Like, those two worked a style of match that I don't think people would associate with Pac and Ricochet typically. They go to Chicago, and I love that Chicago match. It's 10 minutes. It's really compact and precise, and they nail everything they need to. I mean, look, I did not hate this match. I went 3.5 on it. But given the standards of Pac Ricochet, I mean, even the Chicago match, I went 3 3/4 on. So it's not a letdown. It's just the weakest of their portfolio, I think.
That's fair. I went 4 flat. I thought that it was, the things that was really hurt from this was, one, you're absolutely right. Like, they do like something that looked insane. The crowd was reacting. The crowd, this was a really awesome crowd here. B.B. King's did not have a bad crowd throughout its run so far.
And this is the last B.B. King show, so this is it, because they're good. They're good for the United show. They are good for the anniversary show. They're great for Evolve 9, arguably the best Evolve crowd of that era, and then they're really good here.
Yeah. And it's like, I could see like the tail end of it to Harris, but you can't really tell there. The other thing that really brought this match down was the scene on commentary. They were just god-awful. they start off on a really funny note because out of nowhere, Caleb Conley says, "I really like PAC because I like British humor. I love Ricky Gervais." And then Lenny Leonard lets it breathe. Like, this is such a wild thing to say. And then they just became like an active like detractment to this match and that day like this. But I thought that like the big story of like this feud is like, I feel like that it was like PAC was always at this level, but it was Ricochet like finally like reaching that level after all the pomp and circumstance and doing little things like he does like this. They do like this face off of chops where Ricochet was like, "Oh, I'm going to soul butt you." And then PAC keels over and then Ricochet sits on him as he's kneeled over and does a pose. And I was like, all right, that owns. And then the idea of the finish being the spinning heel or being the spinning kick versus anything else, like he unloaded his arsenal. All he had left was to do a kick to the head. And I feel like that was a great like kind of exclamation point for it.
It's a really smartly worked match. Again, it's very different. It's closer to the Fukuoka match than the Spot Fest in Chicago or the Spot Fest in Cork and Hall. I think it's a, you know, if we're talking about DVD feuds like we've talked about on the weekly update shows with Kaito Ishida versus Kaisuke Okuda, I mean, this is a greatest hits album. Just anything Pac and Ricochet did that year in singles or tags, and this would be included. It's a very nice match in their overall story.
That's fair. That's fair. And then we go backstage. If it wasn't, and then we have DUF backstage. They say if it wasn't for John Davis, DUF would be tag team chance. They're flipping out about AR Fox, Sabu, and John Davis. I thought that out of DUF promos, I felt like this was a pretty effective one. It just wasn't really much going on there.
I have had no issues with the presentation of DUF up to this point. I like this promo.
Yeah, and then we had the Johnny Gargano video that we talked about ahead before time. This was really, really long. It talked about his turning points, about the first show, about Ronan, about tapping out Shima. This is, and as I said, I think this is well enough, but having Johnny Gargano narrate it, I feel like detracted from it.
I would completely agree with that opinion. But it's nice to see Dragon Gate USA at least put effort into the production once again, because I think that's a lot of, even by this point, I just felt like Atlanta and the June triple shot and the Midwest triple shot were so sparse on any sort of out of arena production, you know, anything besides a backstage promo that could quickly be shot and thrown onto an iPay-per-view. It's just nice to see the effort being put in with the Chuck Taylor promo the night before and then the Gargano narration tonight.
Oh no, I absolutely agree with you on that. And that led us to the Open the Free Gate title match where Yamato fails in his seventh defense of the Open the Free Gate title. Johnny Gargano wins with a Gargano escape in 26 minutes and 48 seconds to become the third Open the Free Gate champion. It's happened. Johnny Gargano is now Open the Freedom Gate champion.
What are your overall thoughts on Yamato's reign? He wins the title in this building on United New York City, the third match on the show. He goes on to defend it against Austin Aries and probably his best match in the promotion. Akira Tozawa the next night, Yasushi Kanda in Cork and Hall, Pac on the second anniversary show, Shima in Chicago, and Chuck Taylor the night before losing it. It's an impressive seven defenses, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's something where at United New York City, I feel like it was the best match of BB Hulk's title reign there. That was a match I went 3.5 stars on. Austin Aries was like the match that was so weird to watch in retrospect, knowing what all happened afterwards, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was like 4 flat, so I mean, still pretty high on it. The match with Tozawa was the one that we're like, this is happening after like the really bad farewell from Moxley, but Tozawa blinders 4.25 stars. I'm just going through my notebook right now, if you haven't noticed.
No, it's fine with me, because to your point, just to let you catch your breath for a second, but Yamato's reign at least felt like a main event reign. I mean,
right, yeah.
BB Hulk outside of the Shingo match, it's, you know, it's a lame duck defense against Dragon Kid. It's a defense against Doi that is fine. It's a Yoshino against a defense against Yoshino that's fine. He wrestled Mochizuki in the mid card on the first anniversary show and then loses it again, a match 3 to Yamato. Yamato right. At least felt like a proud fighting main event level champion.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, he defeats Shima in a match that I was pretty down on. I went 3.5 stars. And then the final match against Chuck Taylor, I thought was just overall pretty solid. I went 3.75 on it. So it's definitively much better than BB Hulk's reign. I mean, there's no giant eggs like that Susumu match. So there is that. And it does feel like a main event title when the title really had an issue with that, with BB Hulk's reign. And, you know, they picked the right person to win the title. I think Gargano, with the way they built it up here and how the crowd was recepting it, and it's different. It's a different reception than the crowd in Philly was for Chuck Taylor, where Chuck Taylor was like, "This is our guy. This is going to do it." Gargano felt like an ace. Like Gargano felt like, I was like, "Okay, we've done all this work preparing it. Now it's time to see how Gargano goes to the title." And I think that this completed what it needed to complete, and I feel like it was a success in that level.
This is a really interesting match. I have to say, it felt like a big world title match. And that is something that is, I just don't think a match like this, regardless of Yamato being from Japan, I just don't think a match like this can happen in the current US indie scene, where it feels like the result of this match really, really mattered. And even if I had issues with the build to Gargano getting here, especially losing that Tozawa match, still, I understand Gabe wanted like a built-in challenger for him, but that, ugh, I hate that result so much. I have issues with the way they got there, but ultimately when the bell rang and those two were staring across from each other in the ring, I was like, okay, here we go. Like, this is it. This is a big match, and this feels good. The ref bump and Chuck Taylor interference. So Yamato's in the corner, referee's checking on him. It's basically the inverse of a spot Yamato does now, where Gargano hits a corner dropkick, but Yamato pulls the referee into the spot, and Gargano dropkicks the referee instead. Yamato low blows Gargano. They go through some offense. It looks like, I believe it was Yamato had a visual pin on Gargano. It might be the other way around. And then Chuck Taylor comes out with the belt. He goes to hit Yamato. Yamato ducks. He hits Johnny Gargano. Taylor rolls out of the ring. He kind of plays it off like, oh no, I didn't mean to do that, but it wasn't subtle, but it wasn't super effective in the way he did it either. Gargano kicks out of the belt shot, and then from there we go into the proper finish. I don't know. I feel like when Gargano hit the referee, the crowd kind of trolled it, and they're like, oh my god, come on, like, this is what we're doing with this match. Am I off base on thinking that?
Oh no, the crowd was like, okay, and it was really just like, I don't want to say it's deflation, but trolled it is actually a good way to describe it, you know, because the crowd's like, oh, this is what we're doing right now. We're not this is how you're writing yourself out of here, Gabe. Like, it was very much like a smart crowd reaction, you know?
It's a shame. Like, I know I was reading Kevin Ford's review of the show, and Kevin said, he's like, look, I don't have a problem with it because Dragon Gate USA never does this. I would have hoped they would have continued to never do it. I think this was, it was a deflating spot in a match that, you know, Once Gargano kicks out of the belt shot, there's a moment here where, you know, Yamato hits a rolling elbow, Gargano hits a superplex or a super kick, he gets and then, you know, Yamato no sells and hits a Galleria, and it's an unbelievable flurry of offense. I mean, it's so intense and so well timed and kind of peak Dragon Gate style. And then by the end, you know, Gargano gets the win, he submits Yamato in the same building that he submitted Shima and Austin Aries, and it feels like a big moment. And despite some of the flaws in this match, there are flurries of holy shit-worthy moments. I mean, the work in this match, at its best, is so good. By the end, Gargano feels like a worthy champion. I went 4 stars flat. I really do think, despite some of the issues I have with the execution, this is a truly great match.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of those things that you also get Yamato low blowing during that whole the whole heel bump, the whole ref bump thing, which is like, Lenny did a great call of this, saying like, oh, you know, Yamato is no longer a member of Kamikaze USA, but he is definitely someone that will still take a shortcut when it presents itself. And I feel like that was a good cover for something that was completely against like Junction 3 character.
Absolutely.
At the time.
Yeah. No, Lenny was really good in this match. I mean, it's the ultimate Lenny Leonard match, because there's an intricate long-term story being told, and Lenny's able to get those points over while also highlighting the excellent wrestling that's taking place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I went 4 stars flat. You kind of covered my main points there, and the thing is, I wrote down before even the ref bump, this was a really well done cell fest that plays into the melodrama without being over the top.
It's what Gargano's career should have looked like, but when Triple H and Shawn Michaels produce all of your matches, we get a far worse version of this.
Yeah, no, that's what it is. But yeah, 4 stars flat. And for me, if the show would have ended here, this would have been maybe my personal favorite show in DGUSA history.
Mike, just like looking at... Yes, go ahead.
Especially with like this promo afterwards. Like, should we get into the promo afterwards?
Oh, my God. This is what I want to talk about. Mike, this promo afterwards, I'm going to cut you off again. Sorry, I cut you off. I told you to go ahead. I'm going to cut you off again. This promo afterwards, oh, my God. We talked about the Eddie Kingston promo earlier and how, you know, we've all said we want to walk on our hands and knees to Philly to be in support of Eddie Kingston in this match. Well, Johnny Gargano cuts the promo of his life, and he cuts it regarding Drangate USA, the fans, and his work with Chuck Taylor was unbelievable. I'll let you explain it, and then I'll give my thoughts, but I was, oh my God, I was all in on Ronan after this promo.
Yeah. So it was a moment where, like, Chuck was, like, was walking away with the belt afterwards. Gargano appealed to give him to the title. Rich comes out and says that they are the number one tag team, and it plays up Chuck wanting to beat the Spike Mohican, saying, hey, you get your hands on Shima after this. Y'all are the top tag team. You just defeated the other big Blood Warriors tag team. You all should now really go over the United titles. You'll finally get your hands on Shima. I know we all know how much you can get your hands on Shima, and Ricochet's his partner. We know your history with Ricochet, and know you'd like get your hands on him once again. And then they played up there. Chuck hands over the title, teases a kick in the very Chuck Taylor fashion that no one believed that was actually going to be a super kick there, and very sheepishly then pulls him in for a hug. And Ronan is fine with 3 exclamation points.
I just loved this promo. Gargano, he's kind of, and this is before Taylor gives the belt back, Chuck Taylor's sulking in the entryway, you know, just kind of annoyed at everything that's happening. And Gargano says, you know, Chuck, if you really think Shima's holding you down, you know, you need to beat Shima for the tag titles. And who's Shima's partner? It's Ricochet. It's the guy that torments you, the guy that you know best. You need to win the tag titles from Shima and Ricochet. And it's this moment of Ronan unity, and arguably since their debut, the first time where, as a unit of Gargano, Taylor, and Swan, where it feels so cohesive, and I'm so into the story that's being told, and they throw it all away with just nothing, because I'm looking ahead just to make sure that I'm not wrong in this, but the original plan for WrestleMania weekend 2012 was Shima and Ricochet defending the belts against Chuck Taylor and Johnny Gargano, not Chuck Taylor and Rich Swann. We never get another Taylor-Swann match after this built-in story. Now look, they're supposed to team together on Open the Golden Gate. That doesn't happen, and we'll talk about it next week. But to not get them the Mania main event spot with Chuck Taylor fighting for everything he needs against the guy that's held him down in Japan and the guy that's outlasted and destroyed his career by the old merits of just his success, just Ricochet has lapped Chuck Taylor, to not get that match, I hate it so much. We'll have to watch the Miami shows to determine whether or not it's a cardinal sin, but for now, I'm going to stay positive because I think this Johnny Gargano promo of Ronan Unity and what is essentially a did-you-enjoy the show promo, just we have one more match coming later, but what is essentially the go-home promo, it is such a win for Johnny Gargano. He killed it in this scenario, and I have no qualms about him winning the title because he nailed the match and he nailed this spot, and it is awesome.
Yeah, and we'll have someone on with us to talk about these matches when we get to it. Then we have a DUF versus Air Fox, Sabu, and John Davis video. At this point, I was kind of videoed out. Like, I'm glad that he's actually, that Gabe and the promotion's actually, like, putting some force on putting the videos here. But this is after a long match. Before that, had, like, another 5-minute video. This was, like, a 5-minute video. And there were other videos throughout the show that at this point, I was like, all right, I get it, Gabe. You love Sabu so much that you're putting this around this for that. And it just was kind of unnecessary, in my opinion.
Share the wealth a little bit. Maybe spread these video packages out.
Give Uha one. We want to see him cut a promo about being the one-man nation under God with liberty and justice for no man.
Oh, my God. I hate tattoos. I am sick of people my age getting tattoos because they all suck. But I might get that Uha Nation tattoo promo, or that Uha Nation promo tattooed on me. What? Just a nice back piece. You know, something that Ink Master would approve of. Oh my God, I love that promo so much. And, you know, Uha is featured on the show, but not as much as he could have been. What a waste of a weekend for Uha Nation.
You would certainly be living Moss if you did that.
Tattoos on young people. You gotta be 30 before you can get a tattoo, and even then, it's like a 30 to like 35 window, and anything else after that is weird. Because then you kind of get into midlife crisis territory. But these young people and their tattoos, it's a problem, Mike. I don't like it at all.
I have said before that I have two tattoos, and they're both bad tattoos that I got before the age of 30. So you're not wrong.
What am I going to get, like a Pacers logo on Morrissey's head? Like, I don't like anything enough to have it permanently inked on me.
All right, there you go, Guthard, calm down. All right, and that gives us to the main event, the Extreme Warfare 6-man tag team match. The DUF of Eric Cannon, Pinky Sanchez, and Sammy Callahan defeat the put-together team of Air Fox, John Davis, and Sabu when Air Fox gets hit over the head with a beer bottle by Eric Cannon, gets the win in 26 minutes and 14 seconds. And this is not the worst match in the company's history, but boy, was it a match that at a certain point I was looking at how much was left on the disc and going like, okay, we're still doing this. Okay. And it just happened. This match happened, Case. It happened. I know you are a little bit more virulent about it, so go right ahead.
No. Look, you're right. It's not, I don't think it's close to the worst match in Dragon Gate USA history. It's not the worst Sabu match, and I thought everything Homicide did was worse than what Sabu did. I mean, it's the frustrating thing about this match is it's like if BJ Whitmer and Dan Moff versus the Carnage Crew headlined Final Battle 2004, or if Brent Albright and Jimmy Jacobs versus Colt Cabana and BJ Whitmer headline Final Battle 2006. Or if, a more apt example, if the Hangman 3 of Adam Pearce, BJ Whitmer, and Brent Albright against Kevin Steen, El Generico, and Delirious headlined Undeniable 2007, which is the show where Nigel won the belt from Morishima. It would be like if those matches headlined this show. And it's so frustrating because there's no reason this match couldn't have gone after Shima versus Yoshino and then just slide everything else down and have the show end with that Gargano promo. There's no need for this match to be the main event, especially because I'm assuming this show had an intermission. So there's your cleanup time right there. I didn't like this match. It took so long to get going. There's some great spots towards the end, but it was just such a slug to get through. But the placement of it is indefensible. I cannot believe they headlined with this match, and Gabe on commentary did not help.
Oh, no, Gabe was terrible on commentary. This was not any Jimmy Bauer. He was like, I had to sit here, and they actually acknowledged it as Gabe Sapolsky for once, because he's a Sabu, and then he mentioned that he ran the Sabu fan club, and everything made sense.
Oh, God, no, completely. I mean, this whole angle is what Gabe wanted to do because Gabe liked him. Now, look, I get it. You know, if I was running a promotion and Roderick Strong became available, the focal point of my promotion is Roderick Strong dream matches. I understand Gabe wants to book people that he likes, but I'm amazed that he didn't pivot away from Sabu to another ECW guy after the Midwest weekend. The fact that it continued through this weekend and will continue in the future is really hard to stomach.
Oh, no, absolutely so. It's one of those things that I'll have a story about WrestleMania weekend about how I did not watch one of his matches live. So it's indefensible. And this match, you need picture-in-picture to see a lot of it because like the camera's always on Sabu, so you're not seeing what John Davis and Air Fox are doing, which arguably, I mean, again, everything makes sense now knowing that Gabe ran the fan club, and just because like he's like the least interesting person in this match, and you get to see that.
That's the thing. Sabu sucks in this match. If it was Callahan and Cannon versus Fox and John Davis, this match probably rules because there's a really special chemistry with AR Fox and Sammy Callahan that is on display in this match. I mean, Callahan, he hits an exploder suplex off the stage through a barricade, that AR Fox goes over, and then he powerbombs AR Fox from the ring to a barricade on the outside. Like, they beat the shit out of each other, and it was great. The issue is that Sabu is in this match, and he's so slow, And there's a moment towards the finish where Eric Cannon's on a table and Sabu hits a leg drop and you go, great, that's the finish. Sabu wins. The Northeast people go home happy. And then Sabu didn't pin him. And that was when I was like, oh my God, this match needs to end. Like, this is not okay. And it's all because Sabu sucked in this match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something where it's just like this. And like the big spots I always had on screen was them going through a bunch of forks. Like they probably used about a good dozen forks in this match, right? Like just an insane amount of forks. And then the barricade, like going through the barricade is by far the most insane thing. And it was just nuts to see. And it doesn't have Sabu on it whatsoever. Like you like watch the video package for this match of Sabu almost botching his leap to the outside after like this crazy stuff there, and you're going like, huh, okay. If you're someone who does not have ECW nostalgia glasses, I don't.
I want to eradicate ECW from anything post 2001. I hate ECW nostalgia.
But like us not having these glasses, you see this and you see like all the crazy stuff that's happening. You're like, this old guy sucks. And I think Sabu is one of the more important wrestlers of his generation because of who he influenced and what he was doing in his style years before anyone else. Like, I think Sabu has his place in wrestling history and should be celebrated for said history. But that being said, active detractment in the feud, a match that should not have been the main event, especially over a match right before it, you crown your American ace. It's taken him almost 2.5 years to have an ace of the promotion that is someone that they know they can trust to do everything like this. They are not dealing with a lot of politics about. You have all this and you're not have it, and you have this as your main event.
It's like, so unlike Gabe, because this, like, Gabe nailed the execution of Gargano versus Yamato. That is him as a booker. That is where he shines. And he ruined it by having, you know, Gargano Yamato goes 26-48. This match goes 26-14. Even if this match takes 13 minutes, it's a much better match. But 26 minutes for a Sabu brawl in 2011.
It's just infuriating. It's infuriating. So, and the finish of just breaking a beer bottle is so anticlimactic as well. After you see someone go through a fucking barricade. Like, through a steel barricade to the floor. That's your finish, is a beer bottle shot to the head. That's it. That's finish. That's your final, that's your finish of your last show in this venue, which I did not know until you said this, because I thought they still had a show in 2012 here. Nope, this is it. You're closing out your time at BB King's with a beer bottle shot to the head, and then a promo from Sami Callihan saying that DUF is taking over in 2020, and that they're drinking, and if you're willing to drink with them, then you're a DUF as well. That's how they ended the show. That's how they ended 2011.
I still have zero issues with the DUF. I still think their presentation is actually very good. I just hate that they're wrestling Sabu.
And maybe it's something that like the Sabu thing has bled over in my mind to DUF, because they have not been bad, but this was just egregious. It's egregious. Like, fan service is someone that you're obsessed with almost 20 years ago. Almost 20 years ago. If this is 1994 Sabu and this promotion that Gabe Sapolsky is promoting, makes sense. But this is someone going like, hey, I'm a super big fan of you. Would you book Roderick Strong and low pro wrestling in 2042?
The difference is that Roddy will still be in better shape than anybody else on the roster, but I understand what you're saying, so the answer is no.
It's just, I can't imagine, like, after the show, all the Dragon Gate people going back to Japan before the show that they were going to have in Osaka in 6 days going, that was a great use of our time and resources to let someone basically live out his teenage fantasy.
Your star rating for this match, Mike?
Did not rate it. Not rating.
Fair enough. 2.75 from me, and a disappointing way to close the books on Dragon Gate USA in 2011.
The biggest year in the company's history ended with Sabu.
With that in mind, let's close out. We're going to quickly go over four different cars from Dragon Gate Japan and the stuff that mattered on those shows, if that's okay with you, Mike. You ready to move on?
Yep, let's do it.
Let's go to Osaka Prefectural Gymnasium number 2, November 19th. Mike, the matches that matter here, I would argue two of the more infamous matches in Dragon Gate history. It's the Open the Triangle Gate match with KZ, Tanizaki, and Doi against Gamma, Chihiro Tamanaga, and Sajihoko Machine, one of the all-time great telling stories matches. No promotion can even attempt to capture the magic that was caught in a bottle in this match. And then your main event, Ricochet defeats Pac, finally, for the Open the Brave Gate title in a 4 3/4 star match.
And if I'm right, the episode of Infinity is just these two matches.
Yeah, it's the best hour and a half of wrestling you'll ever see. It's an all-time Infinity episode.
It's an all-time Infinity episode. We talked at length about the career of Punch Tomonaga on a weekly update. Go back and listen to that if you want the votes there. And then, yeah, you already talked about it earlier. Like, this is the capping of the year. Like, Dragon Gate's, like, last 6 weeks of 2011, they did such an interesting job of tying up the loose ends, getting everything into place for how everything was going to explode over the next 3 months.
So much makes tape in October, November, and December of 2011. I mean, we could do an entire episode on just those shows, but they're on
just looking at the cards and talking about them, we could.
Yeah, it's because it's really like a lot of the hype goes to the summer months, and rightfully so, those were incredible. But there's just so much that aired at the end of 2011 that it's marvelous, and we're only speeding through these because we want to have a fresh slate for 2012, and these are at the back end of the show. So we'll move on to Shinkaba First Ring, November 30th, 2011, the Blood Warriors Independent Performance First Blood Show. I will read down this full card because this show is a ton of fun. Mike, things kick off with a 59-second Ricky Fuji versus Metal Warrior match. From there we go to the X-Law International title match. X-Law, a lucha promotion that booked the T2P guys during their time in Mexico. El Samurai, their champion, defeats Tomahawk TT. We have the Uha Nation Japanese Landing. He defeats Kotoka in a minute and 30 seconds. Blood Warriors of Horiguchi and Saito, they defeat Takuya Sugawara and Yasushi Kondo. The sleaziest match possible, Open the Triangle Gate match. KZ, Naoki Tanizaki, and Naruki Doi, they defeat Fujita, Nozawa Rongai, and Kiku Zawa, the Kikutaru tribute act of that night.
Well,
Kikutaru himself, yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't want to pull a Lanza there.
No. You are good, my friend. And then your main event, Spike Mohicans defeat Akira Tozawa and BB Hulk to retain the Open the Twin Gate titles in a Blood Warriors versus Blood Warriors match.
Yeah, this was really cool. Like, they did do like a World One Proto show that I feel like we've talked about before, but this was like a really like neat thing that they did, that they didn't do too many of these kind of shows. Like, sadly, like, there was no Be My Friend Till the End show for Best Friends. There was no Mad Blanky Black and Yellow show, but this was just like a really like wild thing that just like nothing on this show other than the matches that mattered got any time whatsoever. But it was just like a good time, and you had El Samurai.
That show aired on Samurai TV. It's out there. I've seen it before. It's been years since I've seen it, but it was a very fun show when it aired.
Yeah. Yeah, sadly, this is the first blood and their only blood. There will not be another one of these shows, sadly.
Indeed. From there we go to Corken Hall, December 1st, 2011, a show that in the opener featured Tanizaki, Kanda, and Uha Nation defeating Gamma, Rich Swann, and Don Fuji. Dragon Kid and Shingo Takagi defeated KZ and Naruki Doi. That match sounds like a lot of fun. Singles match, 15 minutes. Yamato defeats Cyber Kong. And then the stuff on the card that mattered. Pac and Prince Devitt teamed up to wrestle Genki Horiguchi and Ryo Saito. Shima and Ricochet defeated Masaki Mochizuki and Masato Yoshino. Now, Mike, I believe after Ricochet won the Brave Gate title and after they defended them on the Blood Warriors show, they vanquished the Twin Gate titles to focus on their singles titles. That is correct, right?
Yeah. They did a thing saying, like, now Ricochet is the top Brave wrestler, and Shima was announced going for the Open the Dream Gate titles. So it's like, we are going to focus on this. You all have been the new top tag team, so you all... They I think they tried to give him the belts, and then Yagi said, no, we can't do that. And then it was like, that's your top team. Who's going to go against them in Junction 3? And then Kakatora and Suzumi Yokosuka raised their hands.
Exactly.
Great match. Like, really, like, these, like, last three matches on the show, like, there was, like, a time in 2011 where people were going, like, what's up with Prince Devitt? Because you remember we talked about the Wrestling Retribution project that he was supposed to be on. Him showing up here as well, and it was, like, a big thing as well. Like, people were like, is he going to jump? Because, like, you had to think about 2011, that's not like a step down for – that's not a huge step down for where New Japan was in late 2011 to Dragon Gate was. Like, that was like a legitimate like piece of discourse that went around for a little bit.
No,
of course, not true at all.
No, well, at that point, he had been, you know, a juniors champion, a best of the super junior winner. Apollo 55 was an established team for years at that point. I mean, there wasn't a ton of upward trajectory until the heel turn of 2013, which we will discuss in depth when it happens. But it was a logical conclusion to make that maybe Devitt was finishing up in New Japan at the time. And then just to reiterate the main event, 24 hours after losing a Twin Gate Challenge match, Tozawa and Hulk beat Kagetora and Susumu to win the vacant Open the Twin Gate titles.
And this would be the first match on the team that would be later known as the Jimmies. I haven't been able to say that for a while. It's been like almost like 3 months I've been able to say we would later refer to this as this. Yes, I'm excited. I got to say the thing. I got to say my catchphrase. That's a terrible catchphrase.
We'll workshop it. It's okay, though. So there's another Cork and Hall show in December of 2011. It's the Fan Appreciation Show. Nothing really of note happens there. So for the sake of time, we're going to move to Final Gate 2011. Christmas Day 2011, Fukuoka, Japan. One of the biggest shows probably they've ever had. I mean, non-Kobe World.
Yeah.
This might be the biggest pay-per-view they had. Do you have that feeling as well?
It's definitely, like, other than the 2016 one with Doi and Yamada, where it felt like that Doi was coming in so hot that Doi could have been champion, you know? But, I mean, even like that, given the time, you have this main event here. You have Kensuke Sasaki showing up here. You have the team that would be called Yokosuka Chome facing off against Marahi Isapa just as like the first real match on the show. And then like you look at all the title matches here. These are big title matches. And I know you rewatched Shima versus Mochizuki, but I remember a lot of these matches holding up very well.
Yeah, so the show starts off with Blood Warriors of Tomahawk TT, Yasushi Kanda, and Uha Nation. They defeat Don Fuji, Kotoka, and Super Shenlong. Kagetora and Susumu defeated Horiguchi and Saito, as Mike mentioned. There is a 5-minute singles match between Kensuke Sasaki and Cyber Kong. I know on the iHeartDG archives, Jay lamented the fact that they were bringing in Sasaki, and the native crowd, from what I remember and from what Jay wrote, were not into this match. But things pick up from there. Triangle Gate match, KZ Tanizaki and Doi defeat Dragon Kid, Gamma, and Rich Swan. Open the Brave Gate match, Ricochet defends over Masato Yoshino. Open the Twin Gate match, Tozawa and Hulk defeat Shingo and Yamato to retain the Twin Gate belts. I would like to rewatch that. I remember that not clicking with me the first time I watched it, but I also felt that way about the Open the Dreamgate match, where Shima, after 12 months of build, finally defeats Masaki Mochizuki to win the Dreamgate title. Mike, I've said on this show before, I'm not into this match. I don't get it. It's a disappointment to end the feud. I rewatched this during my lunch today, and I'm happy to say I was incorrect. This match kicks ass. It's a 4.5-star match. Shima is unbelievably great in this match, and I don't know what I was watching prior that made me think otherwise.
There's a reason why us old heads were saying like this was the best Shima match. Like, everything here clicked. It's either that or the hair match against him or the Takagi match that happened much later. But yeah, no, this is like the big like summation. Like, if you all, people who weren't around then and haven't like had an opportunity to catch up with this kind of stuff, if you've ever seen the photo of all of Blood Warriors with all the titles, it comes from right after this match, because they have the Triangle Gate, they have the Brave Gate, they have the Twin Gate, they have the Dream Gate, they have the United Gate, and someone has the someone on Blood Warriors has the Ware Gate, and they're all posing with all the belts, and this is like Blood Warriors reigning supreme. This is also, I believe, there's a clip also that went around of like Shima like addressing people in the snow and then crowd surfing. Do you remember that clip?
Oh my god, that's the best. I completely forgot about that.
No, that happened the next year. That's my bad.
Yeah. Because that would have made the broadcast. I closed out of it, obviously, because I didn't need to watch the post-match promo this time around. But yeah, that rules. We'll have to upload that when we get to that in the timeline. But that is the end of Dragon Gate proper in 2011. Mike, we've done all of Dragon Gate USA in 2011. I've rewatched a ton of Dragon Gate proper in 2011. It's probably the best year top to bottom. in the promotion's history, and we will head into 2012 and open the Golden Gate 2012 with Johnny Gargano as your Open the Freedom Gate champion, Shima and Ricochet as your Open the United Gate champions. Your Dream Gate champion is Shima. Your Brave Gate champion is Ricochet. Your Twin Gate champions are BB Hulk and Akira Tozawa. And your Triangle Gate champions are KZ, Naruki Doi, and Naoki Tanizaki.
It is a Blood Warrior heavy time, but things are going to get a lot more interesting before and after this next week in the shows they have, as we're now pretty much full steam ahead. This is episode 28. We'll be back with episode 29 and entering 2012. There is something that we will talk about next show that changes DGUSA and Evolve a lot.
I feel
we should leave on that tease.
Absolutely. The landscape of the Gabe Sapolsky Promotions is about to change drastically. And Mike, before we get out of here, would you like to hear the Open the Golden Gate card?
Yes, but I wanted to toss in Naruki Doi's catchphrase. There are things that we have seen that would backstage that would blow your mind. There, great catchphrase. He doesn't use that much anymore. Like, the winds of change are coming. There's things that I've seen that will blow your mind. That's a great line.
That's really solid. Well, it's solid like this entire Golden Gate show, which will have the Dragon Gate USA debut of Loki in the opener against BB Hulk. We will see the Young Bucks make their return to the promotion against Chuck Taylor and Scorpio Sky, and there's a lot to come on that match next week that we will explain. Naruki Doi versus Masato Yoshino, a tables match with Sami Callihan and AR Fox, John Davis versus Caleb Conley of the Scene with Larry Dallas at ringside, Pac versus Akira Tozawa in a rematch of Mercury Rising 2011, and your main event, Open the United Gate title match, Shima and Ricochet against Masaaki Mochizuki and Jimmy Susumu.
Boy, that is an interesting thing. And I mean, just like an interesting weekend, as we start talking about Wrestle Reunion, there's a lot of stuff that goes on with that. We'll have some PWG notes from the night before, because it's the night before with Kurt Russell Reunion 2, right?
Indeed. Kurt Russell Reunion 3.
I forget they have like their really dipshit numbering thing. They're like skipping numbers.
They did three of those shows.
Okay, so that's just me being dumb. Okay, I'm much more happy with that. Okay,
shots fired at Super Dragon for no reason.
Well, I mean, justified shots, but not at this case.
Yeah, fair enough.
Not in this case. But yeah, that's really about that. That's really it for us here tonight. Thank you all again for listening and sticking with us through a very up and down and left and right and inside out and just twist it all up 2012. I almost said 2020. That's what this year of DGSA has done with me. I'm forgetting time. I feel like a time traveler.
You said 2012. What you meant was 2011.
Yeah. See, twisted me up, Case. Twisted me all up here, and that's gonna do it. Thank you all for listening to Rewind and Rewatch. We'll be back with you next week as we start with 2012 in DGUSA. So for Case, I'm Mike. Take care.